As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Save big money on your outdoor project now at Menards. We have everything you need to keep your outdoor power equipment running smooth, so you can keep that lawn in tip-top shape or enjoy some time on your boat. Right now, all FVP lawn and garden and marine batteries are on sale through May 5th. Check out our entire selection of FVP batteries today and view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals.
Save big money at Menards.
It's no coincidence that we're talking about this film right after all the President's Minutes. Like, this is, so many films tried to be All the President's Men. So many people have tried to recreate it, some quite literally, if in the case of Steven Spielberg. This is the real spiritual successor, I feel. And it's interesting that the reason it's a spiritual successor is that, aside from being, you know, it looks, the newsroom looks just like the Washington Post.
That's,
you know,
great.
There are shots of the two cops running through the newsroom that look like they were storyboarded exactly from All the President's Men running. There are a lot of nods like that, but there is something a lot cleverer going on, because All the President's Men is about a time in history when we lost faith in the institution. But Zodiac is a film for our times, because it's not about the loss of faith in institutions. The investigation in All the President's Men is something we put our faith in. It's a very comforting thing. It's why it's so rewatchable. We take great faith in these people doing their job. In Zodiac, the investigation is the chaos. The cops cannot get straight who has which jurisdiction, who has a fax machine and who doesn't, who got which prints in the mail and who didn't. In All the President's Men, we lose faith in the system. In Zodiac, we lose faith in our ability to investigate the system. And that is a much scarier and much more profound statement. And it's one for our times where it seems like, it certainly feels that every norm is crumbling away in 2020. That's what Zodiac brings out in 2020. It's the fact that you cannot put faith in the newspaper reporter or the detective or really anyone. You know, everyone's doing their best. It's a representation of the chaos that life is, and there's nothing that we can place our faith in fully, because the institutions are only as good as the people who run them, and the people are flawed.
Paul?
What?
I cover crime in Vallejo.
Yeah, I cover crime in Vallejo.
Does one do that?
I like puzzles. I do them more.
He gave himself a name.
This is the Zodiac speaking.
Several crime newsmen are wearing lapel buttons reading, "I am not Paul Avery."
Hey, bullet.
Been a year and a half, you gonna catch this fucking guy or not?
I'm not the Zodiac, and if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
So does anyone think the suspect warrants further investigation?
Welcome to Zodiac Chronicle, a 24-part investigation into David Fincher's 2007 genre-altering masterpiece, Zodiac, adapted from Robert Graysmith's novel by screenwriter James Vanderbilt and starring Jake Gyllenhaal, Robert Downey Jr., and Mark Ruffalo. I'm your host, Blake Howard, and that introduction was award-winning screenwriter and auteurist podcasting mastermind, Lee Zachariah. Joining me today to help discuss the horrific and iconic opening moments of Zodiac are Edgar Award-winning author of She Rides Shotgun and screenwriter Jordan Harper.
I think you can encapsulate both Fincher at his best and worst when I say he's probably one of the best people who uses digital blood.
Staff writer for Slash Film and host of the terrific 21st Century Spielberg podcast, Chris Evangelista.
There, I feel like there's a direct like Jaws riff there, because it's the guy and the girl and they're alone and the girl ends up getting killed, and you know, I feel like that's definitely intentional or not. It's definitely there, absolutely.
And writer, critic, and author with bylines at the New York Times, The Playlist, Vulture, the editor-in-chief of the independent film publication Crooked Marquee, and host of the Fun City Cinema podcast, Jason Bailey.
It so beautifully replicates 70s cinema throughout, but it feels like either he felt, or James Vanderbilt felt, or a producer or studio executive felt, that you had to have those last couple of scenes to give us something resembling some opportunity for audience satisfaction and closure.
So, why Zodiac? That's a great question. Let's step back for a moment and use the invaluable resource that is Wikipedia.com. For those unfamiliar, the Zodiac Killer, or simply Zodiac or the Zodiac, is an American serial killer who operated in Northern California from the late 60s, early 70s, and his identity, for the most part, remains unknown. The killer pronounced his name in a series of taunting letters to the San Francisco Press, primarily the San Francisco Chronicle. These letters included four ciphers. The Zodiac murdered five known victims in Benicia, Vallejo, Napa County, and San Francisco, respectively. The confirmed killings took place between December 1968 and October 1969. He targeted young couples, and two men survived. He also murdered a male cab driver, and the Zodiac himself claimed to have murdered up to 37 victims. But what is it about this case? Why does it have such an effect on people that during quarantine, even 51 years later, three people, an American, a European man, and in fact, an Australian by the name of Dr. Sam Blake, collaborated over the internet in the middle of quarantine to solve a 51-year-old cipher from the Zodiac? Why does it capture people's imagination? First, let's compare it with our previous projects. Heat is the ultimate LA crime epic, a deeply human drama about purpose, about kinship in contradiction. Heat is a nexus for Michael Mann and movie making, a rediscovered 70s-style marble sculpture as a new generation of 90s filmmakers emerge with a scrappy, intertextual collage style. All the President's Men is the ultimate grind. It's the movie that finds the roadwork to mastery of journalistic pursuits, and thereby its very execution role models the gears and the grit required to press up against titanic forces. And tangentially, Inherent Vice, like Chinatown or Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, is a deeply nexus film. It's an autopsy for an age, scribbling the connections of symptomatic decay on a wall for us all to make sense of. Journalists, police, detectives, criminals, obsessives all. And here in 2020, the year that feels more like a decade than a rotation around the sun, the clarity of knowing that you're in a moment, such as those moments reflected in these films, as it's happening, is a really strange thing. So perhaps it's through the portal of a film that intersects a moment like this that takes the time to watch the odometer on characters tick over in sort of real time has an unquantifiable allure. In one of the many commentary tracks on the special edition of Zodiac is James Ellroy, renowned noir author of books like American Tabloid, LA Confidential, and he explains it like this.
I'm an obsessive type myself, and the truth is I've always stayed short of the abyss. Mm-hmm. I possess that kind of circumspection.
Yeah.
Gray Smith didn't go homeless. Gray Smith held down a job and relationships with various women, however tenuous, mm-hmm. during the course of this thing. And he put it together. He read, made some interviews, and made connections that nobody else made. Yeah. And God bless him.
That's just the thing. It's not merely standing on the edge of the abyss and the sublime allure of its power that draws you in. It's an obsession as a kind of possession. Zodiac is a comforting obsession. For some reason, I share Ellroy and this film's affinity with the abyss. Before we get started and deep dive on the opening scenes of this movie, I'm going to have a little chat with my very good friend Jordan Harper, an extremely talented writer and screenwriter, about some preliminary thoughts on Zodiac.
You know, the first thing that comes to mind when I think about Zodiac is my general distaste for serial killer fiction and storytelling. As somebody who considers myself like a real connoisseur of crime culture or cultural explorations of crime, I should say. And I've always been a little hesitant to really get into serial killers past that adolescent bloom that I think a lot of us go through, because there's something I find deeply fascist about the art surrounding serial killers, because so much of stories about serial killers are about control. And, you know, not to start talking about Heat a lot, but Heat is a yin and yang between somebody who is about control and somebody who's about freedom. To me, the bank robber as an archetype is about anarchy and personal freedom and rebellion. Whether or not that's the truth of what bank robbers are, that's the truth of what bank robber fiction or storytelling is. And to me, you know, when you make a serial killer movie, what do you do? Well, you strip a girl naked and you tie antlers to her head and pose her body. And it's about control in a way that no real serial killer is. And then the other side of the story is a cop, which is obviously about control. And so I tend to shy away from that. That's not a blanket statement. There's tons of serial killer stuff I like. But Zodiac is a movie that is not about that. Yes. Or if it is, it is about the frustration and lack of control that people feel. But they never achieve it. There is no sort of final control that is put at the end of the film. And I do think that is what makes it interesting. And I will say, just as a blanket statement at the top, I think this movie's pretty good. I am not somebody who thinks this is a perfect film. I think it is far more satisfying on an intellectual level than it is an emotional level, perhaps because it's so dogged in refusing to embrace the kind of tropes that make even, you know, a total top class serial killer movie like Silence of the Lambs effective is the, you know, that it is trying to make you feel something. And I'll be honest, and I don't want to just ramble here, I'd love to hear what you think. I don't know what Zodiac is supposed to make me feel other than a vague, yeah, that is, yeah, ooh, that is frustrating. Oh, that is interesting. But I, you know, other than a few scenes, including, you know, the one we'll probably spend a lot of time talking about, I don't know what huge emotional event somebody would experience watching this film. And to me, a movie that can't do that is difficult for me to proclaim as a great movie.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that you put it in that way. And I think that that's part of the lure of Zodiac, because for me, I think it's the propulsion of this scene that we're about to focus on, and the propulsion of the scenes around it, this opening kind of 26, 27 minutes of this, what is ultimately about 160 minute epic, is they're like these wounds from your past. They become like these dark and dogged traumatic experiences. And the movie then rolls into this series of recovery, and it ends up being this vacant recovery. So for me, I get what you're saying, because it's like when you're pitting any movie against Silence of the Lambs, which is like one of the most perfect movies that's ever been created, and Jonathan Demme, one of the most deeply affecting emotional filmmakers of all time, it's really hard. Like just in contrast, because they're doing completely different things. But I think what I find in this movie is, I think that question is almost part of the emotional drive. Like, what is this doing to me? Why do I keep needing to watch this thing? It's not satisfying. It's like trauma. It's these moments are traumatic. These things hurt my insides. They make me deeply uncomfortable. This movie, and I think what I think you made the great point is, there's something grotesque when you diminish the impact of life being lost. And in 2020, there's never been a year where people have diminished life being lost more. And this movie, what I'm struck by is that life is lost, and it's so violent and it's so affecting that for the rest of the movie, for me, these opening scenes make you live with a trauma and watch people try and process and resolve that trauma. And there is a lack of resolution. I think that the emotional thing for me is that then what happens, especially for me watching this film, is like you start to think about the trauma in your own life, perhaps, and start doing those internal projections. And then mm-hmm. it's about how you engage with it. But that's what I think is the strange cosmic thing in this movie. I don't think you're necessarily wrong that it shouldn't work just structurally. And someone like you, who is so vastly more aware of like how important structure is to both television and cinema creation and just storytelling in general. Like structurally, it shouldn't work necessarily. And it's not as overtly as affecting, because the things that Fincher is doing is like telling you these stories of violence with the most, you know, rigid focus on the verifiable facts of what happens. And then they happen, and then you have to contend with it. And I think the rest of the movie is just contending with these things. And so that's I think, and again, I don't know. The evolution of this project is going to be fun because I don't actually know where it's going to end up, but there is a cosmic quality to this rewatchability and this obsessive quality that this movie inspires that I guess keeps you going back to these traumatic events, looking at the lack of resolution and seeing how people can find peace with the lack of resolution.
Are you familiar with the idea of a negative flavor?
No,
as opposed to a bad flavor. A negative flavor is something invented by food scientists. And what it is like, say, I read this in the context of Doritos. The New York Times once did a very good article about
food science. Can I just say, I love everything about this conversation so far.
There are something like, and don't quote me on the number here, but there's something like 5 distinct phases of flavor when you eat a Dorito. And all of them are determined by food scientists and built to happen in a sequence. And the final flavor that happens in your mouth when you eat a Dorito is what they refer to as a negative flavor. And again, that doesn't mean a bad flavor. The negative flavor is the flavor that makes you eat another Dorito. It is a flavor in your mouth that, again, is not a bad flavor. It's not like a nasty aftertaste because that might discourage you, but it is a flavor in your mouth that your brain thinks what this flavor requires is another Dorito. And so, you know, it's somewhat similar to the idea of syncopation in pop music and the concept of earworms, which is basically syncopation. And sometimes even like the idea of catchiness comes from the idea of a math problem your brain is trying to solve but can't because it is unsatisfied in the song. And
I think in later Queens of the Stone Age stuff as well, especially Josh Homme's got that obsession with creating like negative zones in songs. Like it's so propulsive. He creates the math equation and the rhythm and the beat of the song and then just kills, like changes the beat or like creates a negative space and you're sort of tapping along and then there's nothing. And then you're like, and then something comes back in and it's like, and it's not even an even beat. It doesn't come back like in the same sequence. It like will interrupt itself like one fraction of a beat faster. And there's this weird thing that your head does. It's like, you become addicted to these gaps and you're like, God damn it. That's, I don't know what it is, but there's something about it.
There's something odd about the, maybe it's just cause this was when I was reading about earworms or it was around the time that Single Ladies by Beyonce came out. And you might never have noticed this, but next time that song comes on the radio, listen for the high-pitched trilling sound that occurs in that song. There is, it's not a melody, it is just like a whoop, 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 that keeps going and you almost don't notice it, but I'm convinced that is one of the like parts of that song that makes it so catchy that now that I've even said that song to you, it's in my head.
And, it's in my head. I've done that, it's in my head, and if anyone's listening, it's in their head too, because it's playing right now.
And I guess, you know, this is all very far afield of saying that I think maybe that's what you're saying, but the fact that the movie is unsatisfying in a basic way, and intentionally so, is what makes it propulsive, this idea that if we come back and keep studying it, which is actually the journey that the people in the film go through as well, I buy that. And I think that is, it's like I said, I do think it's a very good movie. I'm certainly not trying to say it's not a good movie. It just doesn't quite make it to me 5 stars.
You know, our modus operandi, Jordan, I never want to just have a singular conversation with people who are overwhelming fans of something. I think part of the scrutiny is to sort of unpack it. And there are definitely going to be elements throughout the show where we're not just effusively like praising the film. But some of it has to be that internal examination, because I think that that's partially what I'm doing, like in this entire process, is having a look at what makes this movie sort of more even than Heat or All the President's Men that preceded it. What makes this movie that kind of quality? Because Presidents has you know, a restoration of faith moment. And Heat has an undeniable existential musing moment, mm-hmm. as well as being just incredibly entertaining. But this film doesn't follow the same rules.
Oh, no, not at all.
And now, let's dive into the film. The period credit signs are two Titanic movie houses. Warner Brothers, the home of Stanley Kubrick, the director that Tarantino has repeatedly called Fincher our generation's answer to, and Paramount, whose studio rebirth is so tied to the period that Zodiac is set, it feels right that we're joined together in chorus to see this project realized. Fincher and his team, though, stumbled into the shorthand for the audience. What you're about to see is of a time, and in honor of a time. Let's start my chat with Mr. Jason Bailey.
I think a lot about, I listened to the audio commentary once for the first Bourne movie, for the Bourne Identity with Doug Liman. And I don't know why I remember this so clearly, but he talks about how, you know, they just lay in, I think it's like the audio of like a ship. It's like sounds of the sea, because like they open with like him, you know, him being pulled up from, you know, where he's gone overboard or what have you. And in that audio commentary, he talks about how initially that when they first showed it to a preview audience, that audio wasn't there. There wasn't really any sound happening under the Universal logo, which is a longer one. It comes around the planet, etc. And the audience, he said, was just immediately like fidgety, like sitting there in silence was just like not, you know, it's almost like he lost them immediately and had to get them back. But he also said a thing there about, so I can put music there, or I can put in just this little bit of sound effect that will like put them into where we're going to take them, that will sort of set them on that course. And that was a moment where I really realized that you can't waste a single second in terms of setting a scene and getting an audience ready for what's coming.
Yes.
And I think that's what Fincher is doing so brilliantly, even in something as simplistic as the studio logo movies.
Yes.
The little animations that open those film, that open this film. Because like I've always liked it when like filmmakers are having fun with the logo, with the logo movie, because we've seen these forever. We're familiar with them. And so when someone plays with it, it's like, first of all, it establishes this is a playful movie, you know, but also sort of a winking self-awareness of the movie. So like, I love how the Paramount Mountain is used in Raiders.
The Paramount Raiders is the iconic moment. When you see that they're playing with it, it's like, oh, it feels like you can relax. Okay.
Yes.
This is good.
And same thing with how they use the Paramount Mountain in Coming to America. It's like, oh yeah, that's brilliant. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So tinkering with the logo to begin with, like I'm interested. I want to see where you're going. But then this thing that started to happen around this time, I feel like, with using the throwback logo, with using the old school logo to set a mood either of just of a period or of like in Superbad, like you mentioned, of just a spirit. You know what I mean? So like Superbad, as you mentioned, same year, 2007, opens with that old Columbia Torch Lady logo. The one that like, that I think, when I see it, I think of Tootsie. Like that's the sort of like early 80s. That's the movie I've seen the most from that period.
I think
sort of, like, that's the one that
I think of Ghostbusters. That's one of the first things I think
that's
of.
A, that's a good one too.
Right,
that's
around a that good time. One too.
And so it's also like it's a really kind of easy play for nostalgia. Like if you can start a contemporary comedy by making your viewer think of Tootsie and Ghostbusters, like you're already
half
well
your
on
work
the
is
way.
Done. Half your work
yes,
is done.
Yes, yes. Your audience member's like, oh, I'm ready for a Ghostbusters / Tootsie style comedy. Here we go. You know? So the idea of opening, you know, with that sort of, with that 70s era Paramount logo, right? The sort of like the way that the cloud falls and the, you know, that's a specific choice. And then to go with an older Warner Brothers logo. Now he went with like the late 80s, like the sort of Goodfellas era one, which I like don't 100% agree with. Like he should have gone with the Saul Bass.
Gone with the Argo. The Argo Warner Brothers. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Or and Magic Mike.
Magic Mike.
Soderbergh did it too in Magic Mike. Again, like, what great movie. You know, like, if you can start Argo by making your viewer think of All the President's Men, then hey, you know. And same thing with this, I would have thought. But anyway, the point is, he's immediately setting up for you that these, like, it's not just a cute move. It's not just a wink. It's not a joke. It's not a novelty. He's telling you that this is a story and that this is a film. This is a story that's set in the past, but also that it's a film that is grounded in the aesthetics and the storytelling pace and style of these sort of 70s and 80s studio pictures.
Yes.
Like that, to use something that you have to do, like a studio logo, and to find a way to make that a commentary and a nudge and a sort of a waving flashlight on the runway to the audience to know what's coming. That is using every second of your screen time to accomplish something in particular. And really, like, I have such a clear memory of the first time I saw this movie. I saw it in a theater in New York City, opening day, matinee show. You know, sitting down, fourth row, eating, you know, my snack or whatever. And like when those came on, I really, like, I sat back and I was like, oh, fuck, it's on. Okay. All right. And like, you have to be a very specific kind of movie nerd for something that minuscule to have an effect on you.
Yes.
But it did. Like, I immediately was like, oh, okay. And it's such a wonderful way to signal the idea that, like, that Fincher's not making a cutesy period piece. He's not going to, like, wink at us with, you know, bell-bottom pants and, like, flared collars or whatever. Like, he's trying to make a movie that looks like it was made in 1976. Yeah. And put in a vault somewhere, you know, like, and that's a very deliberate choice. And that's a very different kind of filmmaking than just, you know, oh, it's, you know, we're going to have fun with the costumes and the cars. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
And all throughout, like, it's not like he's shooting a 2007 movie that just happens to be set then. Like, top to bottom, this is a movie that is paced like a 70s thriller, that is shot like a 70s thriller, that is cut like a 70s thriller, and that is cast and acted like a 70s thriller. And all of those are discrete, separate, distinctive things that all entail a variety of choices and ideas and personnel, and are all brought together in a way that is fluid and makes sense both as a film and as a storytelling situation. But what I think is really interesting about 2007 in terms of this phenomenon that we're talking about is that, like, you know, you mentioned Superbad, which came out that summer. This came out in March, and then in April, Grindhouse came out, right?
Yes.
And so it's not just that we're talking about the influence of 70s cinema and sort of homage. Like, there was a real, I think, wonderful obsession with the ephemera of 70s cinema.
Yes.
Like, that's a huge part of what Grindhouse was about for, like, again, which I saw in the theater, like, in Grindhouse form. Like, all of the sort of, like, scratchy film and the bumpers and the fake trailers and all of that was, like, it wasn't just about, like, this is a movie that's like movies that we loved and saw in the 70s. It's they're saying, like, no, this is, we're going to do everything possible to replicate the experience of seeing a movie in the 1970s when we saw movies like this.
Yes.
And there's a feeling of that in Zodiac, too. Like, he's not going as far as scratching up screen or missing reels or any of that's of those, like, really, really decisions that work for Grindhouse but wouldn't work for Zodiac. Let's not fuck around about it. But
I don't want a missing reel in the middle of this fucking movie.
I don't. But, like, the opening logos are that kind of thing. They're like, they're repurposing ephemera of 70s cinema to put us into that mood.
Yes.
And to recreate the 70s theater going experience. To make us feel the way David Fincher felt when he saw All the President's Men in the theater, as an example.
Yes.
We sweep into the night, an aerial shot over the bridge. The Hearth City lights are complemented by a chorus of fireworks. We're taking this bridge from our time to theirs. It's the 4th of July, 1969. A fulcrum in the American experience. In a fluid move from the air to a detached reflection of suburbia. Framed from inside a car window, a warm and welcoming slice of life. It's a perfect distillation of post-war prosperity.
Where have you been? I've been waiting since 7.
Get in, I have to find fireworks.
Let me drive.
Get in, I haven't eaten in...
Here's me picking up a chat with Chris Evangelista.
Yeah, that opening shot is just killer, where it's like the fireworks going off all over the different areas, and then that one shot where it's the camera pointing out the passenger side window as it like slowly creeps down the street, and it's like it's just, you're instantly like hooked. It's like, holy shit, this looks amazing. Like, it looks amazing, and you're just pulled into just the vibe of the movie is like instantly ominous. Like, even though it's like a celebratory thing, it's like, ah, 4th of July, everyone's out and having a good time. There's just this instant air of menace, the way that camera is like looking out the car window, and just the way the characters are acting, the way when they just go out and they go to that restaurant and they instantly like leave. And it's just like, it's just slowly setting up that like something is very wrong here. And if you don't know the history of the case, if you're not like, you know, obsessed with serial killers, you don't know what the Zodiac killer things were about, you're really not going to know what's going on here, but you're instantly like clued in that like something is very, very wrong. And it's not going to get any better.
No, and it's, I love what you said there about these are spaces that are safe. Right. And that are like, you're going through a suburban area on 4th of July. And so in Australia, the equivalents are like New Year's Eve, where everyone's out and there's fireworks and sparklers and, you know, everyone's lights are on and music's blaring from lots of houses and people are playing in the street. And it's just, this should be a completely safe space. And then the other sort of sacred American space, even as an outsider in Australia, is like a drive-in diner. Like, there's something romantic about it, all the way back to like American Graffiti, or, you know, you only have to look at like Dazed and Confused. There are these like beacons of light and hope and joy, and the way that this movie opens through these spaces are ultimately terrifying.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And it, like, there's none of that, like, even though it's, you know, it's the 60s, there's none of that like nostalgia, like, ah, look at how cool everything looks in the 60s. It's just like, it's just, I mean, I love that it starts at night. It starts in like, it's just instantly dark. And I also love, one of the things I love about just the movie in general is that this isn't like the first Zodiac killing, but Fincher did this thing, and the script does this deliberate thing where they only portray crimes that had at least one survivor.
Yes.
Because they're only interested in you know, telling the truth, quote unquote. They're only like, you know, this is a very, you know, the other reason I think that I love this movie so much is like, I'm just a sucker for newspaper movies where like, we got to get to the truth no matter what, we got to uncover the truth. And this script and this movie is very interesting.
Something you might say that we share.
Yeah. this movie is very interested in getting it right. Like, it doesn't want to take liberties. And like, yeah, it's taking liberties in the sense that, you know, it arrives on a suspect and zeroes one suspect out, even though there's no, you know, there was never like a trial to say that guy did it. But the movie is very interested in not sensationalizing things. And I love that. You know, this could have opened with, you know, the first actual Zodiac killing, but instead it cuts to the first one where someone survived. Like, we're not even like getting the whole story. We're instantly jumping into a story that's already ongoing, but we just don't know it yet. And I just love that little detail that it's only interested in showing these things where there was at least one person left to say what happened.
Mike's nerves are expressed in this flashy tick, opening and shutting a Zippo lighter. D is beautiful, a picture of a woman. Mike looks like a weedy kid, insecure and jittery. His nerves can barely handle the fact that he's been made to wait. The whole time this scene unfolds, the static camera inside the car provides the POV. It is both D and this omniscient postcard view. There's a handoff, though, when we look back into the car and materialize Mike's view. The camera has created another presence. As Mike enters the car, and Mike and Dee make their way out of the street, something has been left behind. The American ideal has been developed in front of our eyes, and we're now moving past it. There's such an ache being left behind in that moment. The passage from the 60s into the 70s, from a time of innocence to a time of fear and manipulation by serial killers, must pass through a 50s drive-in diner. There's a moment as they creep through the drive-in looking for a spot when Dee postures up and catches something in her rear view.
It's too crowded.
The glance is less than a second, but the rigidity of her body cannot contain her discomfort. Quiet. The cagier, already frustrated Mike is concerned with the move. Do you blame him? Once they arrive at their spot to talk and listen to music, Dee turns on the charm and reassurance to comfort Mike. Here's a great observation from Jason Bailey about the sound of the radio in this scene.
I hadn't ever really noticed how beautifully the music and the radio is used, driving and listening to the radio. And it really tied to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood to me. Like, he uses the way a radio sounds in a car, which is a very specific kind of listening to music, and the way that it can envelop a night when you're just driving around. That's, I don't know, when I watched Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, that felt like something I hadn't seen before in a movie, and then I watched this again and I was like, no, I'd seen it once before in this. It's really lovely, that little sequence of her just driving down the street and the fireworks are going off, and her picking him up, and then them going to that drive-in, and it's and the way that the music and the DJ sound in that car. I don't know. It's really lovely.
Sitting, listening to music, talking.
You seem weird. Is everything okay?
Yeah, everything's fine. July. How many shirts are you wearing?
I'm cold.
You're cold on the 4th of July.
When those other Parkers prank them on the way out with firecrackers, Mike must flex his toughness. He shouts,
"I'm tough and die!"
Such a strange moment. Such a strange turn of phrase. And the invective and the teen tone of the statement is laughable. Dee can't contain herself.
What?
Fuck off and die?
Shut up.
In just a moment, we'll be back with Jordan Harper to talk the relevance of Hurdy Gurdy Man and its use in the movie. But let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsors. Okay, so we all know how a VPN protects your privacy and security online, right? But I didn't know this until recently, and it's taken my TV watching game to the next level. You can use a VPN to unlock movies and shows that are only available in other countries. Over the weekend, I used ExpressVPN to binge Rick and Morty on French Netflix. It was so simple. I just fired up the ExpressVPN app, I changed my location to France, refreshed Netflix, and voila! See? ExpressVPN hides your IP address and lets you control where you want sites to think you're located. You can choose from almost 100 countries, so just think about all the Netflix libraries you can go through. Love anime? Use ExpressVPN to access Japanese Netflix and be spirited away. But it's not just Netflix. ExpressVPN works with any streaming service. Hulu, BBC, iPlayer, YouTube, you name it. There are hundreds of VPNs out there, but the reason I use ExpressVPN is to watch shows, and it's ridiculously fast. There's never any buffering or lag. You can stream HD, no problemo. Hello, Criterion Channel. I'm looking at you, kid. ExpressVPN is also compatible with all your devices. I definitely have it on my phone, but you can get it on consoles, smart TVs, and more. You can watch what you want on the go or the big screen wherever you are. Now, if you are a fan of One Heat Minute Productions and all that we do, I know you want to help us out. So please visit our special link right now, expressvpn.com/OHM. You can get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. Support the show, watch what you want, and protect yourself at expressvpn.com/OHM. And now, back to Jordan Harper and the Hurdy-Gurdy Man.
Well, you know, like most people, I discovered the song Hurdy-Gurdy Man through the Butthole Surfers, their album PO'd. Where they covered the song. Now, when I was in high school in the Butthole Surfers, do you know them?
I do.
Psychedelic trash rock from Texas. One of the great bands of the 90s. And the thing about the Hurdy-Gurdy Man is when you hear it in the context of the Butthole Surfers album, which is as weird as rock music gets, I had no idea it was a cover. And it sounds exactly like a Butthole Surfer song. And so when I learned it was a cover, I was like, I've got to hear the original to see how much the Butthole Surfers made it weird and creepy. And it turns out they didn't do shit. That Donovan's song, The Hurdy-Gurdy Man, is got to be the creepiest song that has ever broken the top five of the pop charts.
Yeah, a huge pop song.
A huge pop song. And it is truly an unnerving song to listen to. And interestingly enough, and I just learned this today from Wikipedia while I was preparing to talk to you, the first movie to use the Hurdy-Gurdy Man,
yes,
was Dumb and Dumber. And they used the Butthole Surfers version. And then it started getting used after that. It's in sneakers. It's been in a lot of stuff since, but yeah, it was Dumb and Dumber, which has a weirdly good soundtrack for the movie Dumb and Dumber. also has XTC's Peter Pumpkinhead. Great song. Anyway, Donovan is a really interesting character that is almost better known for some people by having such famous friends. You know, he's in that 1965 Bob Dylan documentary.
Yes.
The name of which just fell out of my head.
Is it Don't Look Now?
Yes. And, he actually wrote big chunks of Hurdy-Gurdy Man while he was in India studying with Maharishi with the Beatles. And in fact, George Harrison helped write the lyrics to this song.
It has a lot of George. This song has George fingerprints all over it.
Well, the other big place that it has the fingerprints and really one of the essential parts of the song is the tambura, which is the Indian instrument that really is used to great psychedelic effect. And you're right, in a very George Harrison way in this song. But that's not the end of like the weird fame level of this song. When you look at it, apparently Donovan says anyway, he wrote it for Jimi Hendrix, which
really,
yeah. When you hear it, yeah, obviously Jimi Hendrix wouldn't have put the weird spookiness on it, but boy, that would have been a good song to hear. I would have.
He would have given it like this, like spiritual magnetism. Like it would have been propulsive. It would have been like a chant, like some of his songs can turn out to be. Whereas this is just like this is the most perverse prayer. It's weird. It is weird.
And it is very weird. And this is, you know, I haven't done a tremendous amount of research about this, but when I looked into it, nobody's 100% sure, because it was like the late 1960s and they were all on truly stupendous amounts of drugs. But amongst the people credited for playing on this song, Jimmy Page is credited with guitar work.
Yeah, I mean, look, if you just need an extra session guitarist, why not Jimmy Page, you know?
Well, but the interesting thing is we're not done here. John Bonham is credited with the drums. And John Paul Jones is credited with bass and production, at least partially. And all of these are partial. There was also some jazz fusion guitarist who's also credited with the guitar. But if you listen to it, you can hear the Jimmy Page. So essentially, if this is all correct, pre-Led Zeppelin, Led Zeppelin is the backing band of this song, which is incredible.
Led Zeppelin. Yeah, Donovan's just like, oh, we shouldn't make a band with these guys. Let them go off and do whatever they want.
Yeah, I don't care about these people. I've got to go record Mellow Yellow. I would say this song, used the way it is in this film, where it adds an obviously creepy moment, a lot more creep, and it is a very one-for-one choice. It's a good choice, and it's the best song choice in the movie, I think, by a country mile.
And its deployment. I think that song choices are incredible in movies, and there's deployment. And look, you know, coming over a scene or how it's done, but it is on the radio.
I think it's interesting because I think when people describe Zodiac or when they think of Zodiac, they really think of the other murders. What I mean is, I think people say, well, he films the violence so matter-of-factly, and it's unaffected, and you just get the horror of the close-ups of their faces, and he's not manipulating you. Where, well, first of all, I think film's job is to manipulate you, but like this does all of those things. It takes
all of them. Very
creepy song. It you know, deploys it, like you said, the music swells. It is no longer just playing on the radio. It's not diegetic anymore. It's now non-diegetic. It is taken over into the soundtrack of the film itself, as the puffs of blood, the not too terrible digital puffs of blood are
it's probably the best digital blood, because that and actually one of the most profound and smart reasons for doing it is, when they were shooting this slow motion, they didn't want to cover the actors in blood.
Sure.
To reset.
Yeah.
So if you're talking about like how to reset, you know, if you're doing the scene and you can look at the dailies, and with digital photography, you can literally just do playback almost instantaneously. They're watching it happen and they're going, okay, we want to do that again. And imagine if, you know, knowing what Finch is like, imagine if like they had squibs and had to bloody that car and then clean the car, or have alternate cars, or have alternate, you know, dresses and things like that. I think that would have just been insanity. Insanity.
I think you can encapsulate both Fincher at his best and worst when I say he's probably one of the best people who uses digital blood.
Yeah.
that, yes, he does it very well, and you barely notice it unless you're like me and are angry about digital blood. but it is a limit of his perfectionism and his need for control, again, to bring it back to this concept of control. That, and by the way, these, what you just said is the argument that everybody like me hears in a production meeting when I say, I don't want it to be a digital squib. Can't we use a real squib? Well, we have to reset, and it takes time. It costs real money. It is the way of the world now that everybody uses. I'm sure that there are digital squibs in The Irishman. I can't really recall, but I'm sure there are. But actually, bring up The Irishman. The hurdy-gurdy man in Zodiac is the second best usage of Donovan in a movie. And I think exploring the parallels and differences between this usage of Donovan in a movie and the best usage of Donovan in a movie, which of course is in Goodfellas, is incredibly instructive. Because by my way of thinking, if you asked me to name the greatest use of a song in cinema, I would probably say Donovan's Atlantis during the killing of Billy Batts in Goodfellas.
Yeah.
I think it is incredible, and it's incredible in a way that really brings Scorsese's genius to the front, because the Hurdy-Gurdy Man is a creepy song.
Yes.
To use Hurdy-Gurdy Man in a scene to make it creepy, it's great. Don't get me wrong, it's great, but it's one for one. It's a creepy song.
I don't think it's an unfair statement to say that some of the most profound bits of score or needle drops that are in movies are how they are offsetting and undercutting potentially what you're seeing. And then there's this weird cycle. I think it's that whole, to go back around to something we've talked about, which is that whole negative taste vibe, which is it's doing something that makes you notice it.
Yes.
And then it contends with what you're seeing at the same time, and then they complement together. And if you can sometimes get the experience where there's a fusion of those two things, it takes it to another level that it wasn't going to hit before.
That's exactly it. And that's where, you know, Donovan's Atlantis is a song about really wanting to date a woman from Atlantis. That's what it's about, more or less. You read it, it's like, boy, I wish I could swim under the ocean and date this lady from Atlantis. But if you don't pay attention to the lyrics, which my firm belief is that filmmakers should not pay attention to the lyrics of the songs, and just listen to it as a thing that is happening, it is an emotion and a feeling, it is a profoundly sad song. And The Murder of Billy Bats is a profoundly sad murder. And what it does is it takes something without pulling back on the violence, without hiding anything or denying all those things, what the idiots say when they talk about Scorsese makes violent movies that are just about violence. It doesn't get away from that. Joe Pesci breaks a gun against a guy's face in this scene. And yet this song that you barely even notice is playing makes it perfectly clear that this is a tragic act. And it is not just tragic for Billy Bats, but it lays Joe Pesci's insecurities bare. It's a sad crime. And I really think that Donovan's song has so much to do with it in that scene. And to me, and I just bring it up because I think it's interesting to use this artist to compare the two. That is where Scorsese rises above. It's an inspired choice that nobody but him would make. It's, you know, period correct, as is the Hurdy-Gurdy Man in this scene. But it wasn't the first song somebody would pick. It's the thousandth song somebody would pick for that scene. And it's so much better than all of those. And so I really do think, to me, when I think about Fincher as, you know, supremely talented, but, you know, sometimes when his name gets pushed into that next level conversation, I'm resistant to it because I don't see that kind of work from him. I don't see that kind of inspiration from him. And I think that this is a great moment to point that out, even though, to just go back to the scene now, it is a profoundly disturbing scene. It is uneasy. It's uneasy from the moment that she picks him up. There is so much backstory that we don't get. Their relationship is so odd and it's never explained. But, like, you know, even the fact he doesn't want to get in the car when he first meets her, there's something strange about it. She goes to the drive-in and then doesn't want to eat, even though she says she hasn't eaten. Are we to draw something from that? Can he? We don't know, because she dies and we never get to ask her. And already, even though there are fireworks going off, it's an uneasy feeling before, as you point out, you know, the song doesn't start until, you know, is it when the firecracker guys leave, right? And they're like laughing about it. And she's like making fun of his like high-pitched threat to the guy. Fuck off and die!
It's the greatest.
It's interesting when we go back to these ideas of negative tastes and unfulfillment, that there is a mystery that is posed in that scene between the two of them that is never solved. And we are never given an answer for why they're acting this way, you know. You get the idea they're not sleeping together, but perhaps they will be soon. He's certainly aware that she has a husband and he is worried enough about what they're doing to ask, is that your husband? But they're clearly not in a sexual relationship yet because they're not acting like it. And, you know, the violence in the scene, it is matter of fact in its way. It's filmed straight on. It is, you know, it doesn't hide what it does, but it is, by far in this film, the most like kind of stylized and deploying all the different elements of film, as you point out, there's slow motion. You know, it does, again, it's an iconic song choice. And I think, you know, so our friend Jen sent us a tweet recently where somebody made a Mank joke using the Hurdy-Gurdy Man as the punchline. And it really is the probably single most iconic moment in this film. And the song choice is just spectacular. And the fact that Dumb and Dumber got there first, well, hey, that's how it goes.
That's just, you know? Just how it goes. We're all beaten by Dumb and Dumber at some point. Dee is doing everything to maintain intimacy in the scene. But a car approaches. The camera clocks its arc. And it parks menacingly close. In some ways, I'm reminded of that great moment in The Dark Knight Rises, as Bane places his hand on the shoulder of Ben Mendelsohn and says,
"Do you feel in charge?"
The menace of this car's presence is debilitating. This is a quote that comes to mind. Often, the worst and most embarrassing part of the film is the accidental, the uncontrolled, the amateurish failure
which exhibits its unachieved intentions. And the finest moment may be a twitch of the actress's cheek achieved on the 50th take. There are accidents which look like art, and there is art that looks accidental. That is a quote from Pauline Kael from her essay, Is There a Cure to Film Criticism? From I Lost It at the Movies, Film Writings from 1954 to 65. Chiara Moriarty's performance as Darlene Ferrin, D, as I've been calling her, achieves a moment with the essence of accidental. She's wrestling and twisting her mouth in preparation to answer, but it's as if her braces are shackling her very expression. Despite not knowing he's behind the wheel, this is a serious man, creeping in from the shadows. The Mustang's muscular angles cry out that there's an assertive beast waiting to pounce.
Stay in the car.
Let's have a quick chat with Chris Evangelista about what he thinks are overt Spielberg tones in this moment.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I feel like there's a direct, like, Jaws riff there, because it's the guy and the girl and they're alone and the girl ends up getting killed, and you know, I feel like that's definitely intentional or not, it's definitely there. Absolutely.
Is that your husband?
As the car rolls away, ripples of relief register in Dee's face. It's like this uncontrollable adrenalized chill kicks through her like a static shock. For the entire exchange, the car has been this black metallic beast. The incongruity of this pairing finally makes sense. Darlene is a dissatisfied woman. She's railing against her marriage with a series of different suitors. Mike in the car is one. The man in the other car is not her husband. But Mike isn't wrong to ask. This unflinching lens doesn't judge Darlene. The filmmakers want to make it clear that whatever people may have going on in their lives, this shouldn't be the way that they end. We stay in the car, the ethos of the film. Crimes that were selected to be portrayed all have witnesses. Robust police reporting that allow those living people to be able to inform the details of what's being portrayed. Dee is glacial, porcelain. The braces don't diminish her glow. In the tension of the threat of the Mustang and its driver, she drained. The car driving away, Dee attempts to restore equilibrium. As she reaches out with delicacy and comfort, this scary moment should be precisely that, a moment. Her poise absorbs the noise of the screeching car returning. The camera turns on a swivel and tracks the car, blocking them in their space. Dee's nostrils flare. They chart her awareness, her familiarity. This could be bad. She knows that the threat of violence from this figure is real.
Now, Dee.
As the driver puts on a torchlight and walks to Mike's window, Mike is a white kid that would never imagine a figure of authority adopting the entitlement of a cop and inspecting their intimate moment would be a fatal threat. In 2020, there have been countless examples of black people in cars waiting to comply being gunned down. There's not a presumption of innocence. In the hands of the authority and the torch wielders is the same fear, anxiety, and insecurity we see in Mike. They have become the ones who think, I'm not getting shot for this, and that means that someone else will. The fear of Zodiac's exit from the car is compounded on revisitation. His callousness is underscored by a further problematic reality. Law enforcement aren't there to protect us in the same way we imagine. Glare is binding. Time slows down. It's the Fincher Peckinpah moment. In fact, it's probably one of the truest applications of slow motion Peckinpah style violence that I can recall.
Man, you really creeped us out.
So many people looked at the use of slow motion in Peckinpah films simply as an aesthetic choice rather than its emotional heightening. The fragility of the human body in the adrenalized climactic moments can appear to those inflicting or experiencing it to be slowed down. Devastation takes on a grace that's hard to explain. In this moment, the filmmakers have calculated to the deepest specificity that the deaths in this film will not be glorified, but rather they'll recall and catalogue the scope of the devastating loss of life through a commitment to the documented reality of these killings. The killer returns to his vehicle, and for the briefest of moments, you feel like this horrific event is over, only to have him return, gun replenished and ready to kill again. The second volley, we're taking a more objective and passive view of the scene, their isolation and Zodiac's eventual escape. Here's Chris Evangelista and I talking about the chilling, unforgettable quality of this exchange.
That first kill like sets the tone for the whole movie, where it's just, it's like this senseless, mindless murder that came out of nowhere that, like, yes, we go into this movie, we know it's about a serial killer, we know people are going to get killed, but we're not prepared for this ultra realistic take. We're not, like, numb to that yet. And I think that's part of this movie's power, where it's trying to do things that have been done before in different ways. You know, there are, you know, Zodiac isn't the first serial killer movie. Zodiac isn't, you know, it didn't break the mold, but it's trying to journalistic, I guess is the word I'm looking for here. It's going for this journalistic approach where it's giving you just the facts. Like, it's not playing around with the continuity. It's not playing around with the details. It's giving you everything that happened as it happened in the best, most historically accurate way it can. And I think a lot of violence in movies, not to make me sound like a lunatic, but a lot of violence in movies is kind of like therapeutic and kind of rewarding. Like, we, you know, if there's, like, you know, if I'm watching a horror movie and there's, like, a well-executed bit of gore, that's exciting. That's fun. It's like, oh, that looks fucking cool. And the
very recently in Freaky, when the killer gets a tennis racket and puts it through a preppy guy's head on either side, and, like, he rejoins it. I was like, that's cool.
Freaky is actually what I was just thinking of, because Freaky has some really great practical gore in it, which is, like, I was like, oh, this is fucking great. This is like a throwback to back when, you know, there's this thing that a lot of horror movies do now where, like, all the gore is like CGI and you can tell, and it really bothers me. And Fincher actually uses, like, the blood in this shot is actually CGI, but it doesn't matter because he's not going for that therapeutic violence. He's not going for that cool gore. He's going for violence that is meant to upset you. Like, he's not trying to be like, look at how cool this action scene is. He's trying to be like, oh shit, this is disturbing stuff, and I want to disturb you. I want to unnerve you right out of the gate. And just the way the shooting is done, like, after that slow motion breaks, there's that wider shot, and then the Zodiac killer walks away and even, like, comes back and keeps shooting. And, like, that's such a cold, like, uncaring bit of you know, violence that just, like, it's unnerving. Here comes a roly-poly man, is singing songs of love. Roly-poly, roly-poly.
From the vantage point of the bushland, a gaggle of geese hurry past the camera. A policeman arrives at the scene on a motorcycle and sees Mike. Through gritted teeth, wincing, a goatee of blood, gesturing to the vehicle, to D. There's been a venomous accuracy from the killer to D. The score retreats slightly, and the anonymous phone call to Vallejo PD settles over Mike's agony. The details, the stats, the damn scoreboard of this killing. Emboldened to also confess his last murder too.
Vallejo Police Department.
I want to report a double murder.
May I have your
if you
name
go 1 mile east on Columbus Parkway, the public park, you'll find kids in a brown car. They were shot with a 9mm Luger. I also killed those kids last year. Good.
It's not a fade to black, it's a cut. That cut to black moment is the moment for Zodiac that reflects the American ideal extinguished. The currents of this moment are going to cascade through popular consciousness. The media is going to make this psychopath mainstream. The boogeyman under the bedrock of San Francisco. And some closing thoughts from Chris Evangelista and myself.
He's gone on to express, like, three major things in one movie, because, and I think that's part of the allure for me to approach this, because it's not just, you know, an obsessive cop who's actually a good cop, you know, Toski, even though he's, you know, his hubris gets to him, as we see later in the movie, played by Ruffalo. It's not only a very, like, a fascinating blowhard journalist who's just, like, you know, Robert Downey Jr. at his most extremely fun and unhinged to watch, like, you know, just complete fun, or a nerdy obsessive played really, you know, really beautifully and on point by Gyllenhaal, who's obviously got his own magnetism and is an actor, but is like a really incredible performer. And you've got these three completely layered, huge stories in a lengthy film and told and executed, plus all of the incredible side characters, you know, like I do entire viewings of this movie where all I'm watching is Elias Koteas, you know, or Anthony Edwards, or you know what I mean? Like these people who are just like Donald Logue, like, they, you know, you get these different characters who have to interact and play in their same sandboxes, and they're just so fun and so realized full characters themselves. But this movie is just, you know, it's such a monumental challenge to have these this three protagonist story that's layered into this one story in amongst this incredibly, you know, realized historical, I guess it's like an epic crime film. We're going to be disturbed. We're going to be inspired. We're going to be obsessed. We're going to, you know, show some great cop stuff. We're going to show some great, you know, great interrogation scenes, great investigation scenes. And then we're going to show this sort of like hodgepodge, you know, DIY investigation later, which has a great charm in its obsession and sort of, you know, being a bit rough around the edges.
I don't know what else I could say after that. Like, you just like summed up the entire film and why it's so goddamn special. But it's amazing to me that this movie works as well as it does, because if like one of those many things you just listed went wrong, like the whole thing like capsizes and like,
yes,
it's like, oh, well, that was a dud.
That was the first episode of Zodiac Chronicle, Sagittarius Part 1. Sagittarius Part 2 will be dropping on December 31st. Be sure to subscribe to One Heat Minute Productions and Zodiac Chronicle so you're the first to know about all of our upcoming episodes and projects. If you can't get enough, Unplugged Zodiac Sessions will be available exclusively on the One Heat Minute Patreon, linked in our show notes. This episode of Zodiac Chronicle was researched, written, and presented by me, Blake Howard. The music of Zodiac Chronicle is composed, produced, and performed by Chris Duffy of Los Espinas. Our companion I Am Not Avery Zodiac Chronicle stickers were done by the talented Amy Reed, who you can find on Instagram at ai.me.me or via email at amy.reed0310@gmail.com. Until next time, goodbye.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.